Okay, thank you. So I'm here to present literally just an idea that Bodan Pachinski has on how to detect GRB central engine behavior in the absence of gamma ray detection, i.e. how to detect gamma ray burst central engine behavior in the optical at early times. So an outline of the talk is, I'll first give you an overview of gamma ray burst and gamma ray, in particular gamma ray burst afterglows. I'll give you an overview of what's known as ACES, the All Sky Automated Survey, which is a system that's already up and running in Las Campanas, Chile. And then I'll talk about how we can use this system, the ACES system, to detect on-axis optical GRB afterglows, and then I'll conclude. And I warn you, this whole talk is highly qualitative. We haven't worked anything out yet, but I'd like any of your feedback on this, on these issues. So GRBs and their afterglows. So this is a common picture for long duration of order 10-second gamma ray bursts, which are thought to occur at approximately a redshift of 1 or 2. The idea is that gamma ray bursts are display jet-like behavior with a moderate geometric beaming of order 0.1 radians at early times when the outflow, relativistic outflow, is still at large Lorentz factors of order 100. You get prompt gamma ray emission, supposedly from what's known as the internal shock mechanism. And then at later times when the outflow decelerates, you get afterglow emission at all wavelengths from gamma to radio, and at very almost all time scales, from anywhere from seconds, characteristic time scales from seconds to years. The typical energy associated with these outflows for gamma ray bursts is of order 10 to the 51 or 10 to the 52 erg, so it's supernova-like. And due to the large relativistic Lorentz factors of the outflow of order 100, with, that is, the energy of the outflow divided by the mass of the flow, is of order 100. This requires to deposit supernova-like energies in a very small amount of mass of order 10 to the minus 5 solar masses. And it's very difficult to see how one does this, and this is what's known as the baryon loading problem. These large kinetic energies requires the conversion of about a tenth of a solar mass to a full solar mass worth of binding energy, gravitational binding energy, into kinetic energy with supernovae-like efficiency. So this has led people to think that the central engines of these sources are powered by supercritical accretion or gravitational collapse onto a compact object such as a neutron star or a black hole. And the more or less all kind of models for central engines are very similar to one another. They're more or less just variations of one another, and we really don't understand how the central engines, what the central engines are or how they work due to the large optical depth to where the energy is deposited. And some of the names of these kind of fantastical ideas are collapsars, compact mergers, neutron star mergers, for example, magnetars, so on and so forth. However, you can at least deduce quite a bit of information about the nature of gamma ray bursts from their afterglow emission. And so afterglows right here are the result of the smooth interaction between a relativistic outflow with the ambient interstellar medium. That is, shock heating leads to cooling via synchrotron emission, supposedly. This allows for the detections of gamma ray burst central engine activity over an enormous spread of wavelengths from radio to gamma, and over an enormous spread of timescales from 10 seconds to of order a year. And afterglows end up giving you almost everything you could tell or want to know about gamma ray bursts other than what their central engines are, i.e. they provide what the positions and the hosts of gamma ray bursts are, the geometry, and thus the energetics of a given burst. Okay, so the main concept, physical concept, that is important in terms of afterglow physics for this talk is beaming and the jet break of gamma ray burst afterglows. So what is the concept of the jet break? Well, at early times when the gamma ray burst outflow, the relativistic outflow, is collimated into a jet. As long as the Lorentz factor is relatively high compared to the jet beaming angle, the outflow thinks that it is spherically symmetric. And this is true as long as the Lorentz factor of the flow is larger than the jet beaming angle. So when the flow slows down such that the Lorentz factor is of order the jet beaming angle, then the jet finally realizes that it is a jet, and it starts to expand. As the lateral expansion occurs, also lateral emission occurs. And the jet slows down by a factor, slows down in such a way that its light curve steepens to a 1 over T squared power law. At early times, the light curve in the optical, for example, falls off as 1 over T. And this is a result of a conspiracy between a relativistic self-similar outflow coupled to synchrotron emission. The time scale of the jet break ends up constraining, which is usually of order a day, constrains the total burst energy and off-axis afterglows, which in this plot from Nakur and Perron, Ehud showed this in his talk yesterday, if you were to view gamma ray burst central as giving gamma ray burst central engine at late times in the optical, such that your viewing angle is relatively large to the jet beaming angle, then you could detect it in the optical. But at those times, the flux goes down like 1 over T squared. Detections of this sort are what are known as orphan afterglows or homeless afterglows or whatever you want to call them. Yeah, that's kinder. Okay. So what does this actually happen in reality? Well, these are some of the, I guess, relatively famous examples of optical afterglows from gamma ray bursts. One at a redshift of 1.5, one at a redshift of 0.15. They both are thought to have similar energies and beaming, and they look quite a bit similar. Here, for this kind of typical canonical GRB afterglow, the break happens around one day. It's achromatic, as it is in the case of this one. And this one, of course, is much brighter because it's much closer. What you gain in the viewing angles, the large viewing angle increases the detectability, but the rapid fall off at late times, the 1 over T squared, ends up killing you. So this heavily decreases the number of detectable late time orphan afterglows. So what beaming gives you, it taketh away, basically, at least at late times. So maybe it's interesting to look at the early time behavior of GRB afterglow. So this is a plot of folks from Texas, I believe, Quimby and McMahon, of basically a compilation of GCN data of early optical afterglow behavior of gamma ray bursts. So from a time of 10 seconds to about 1 day or so, the flux seems to roughly fall off like 1 over T, maybe, I don't know, maybe it falls off like 1 over T to the 1.2 or something in this plot. And so this implies that the detective, so this is a very important fact, that the flux falls off like 1 over time. So this implies that the detectability of on-axis orphan afterglow, or on-axis optical afterglow behavior, is independent of the limiting magnitude of your survey, as long as you can sample the entire sky before the jet break time, which is of order 1 day or 10 to the 5 seconds. So therefore, instruments that are deep and narrow are comparable to those that are shallow and wide. So perhaps it follows that perhaps an independent method of detecting GRB central engine activity is to look for on-axis afterglows, or this early time behavior, with an all-sky survey that's blind, that can scan the entire night sky within a night or so. So from that, let's introduce this ASAS system, or the all-sky automated survey. So ASAS consists of four small instruments. Two of them are located currently and working in Las Campanas, Chile, and two are coming soon in Hawaii on the timescale of order of months. As it stands, the primary objective of ASAS is to monitor the variability of bright stars. It's really quite a modest survey. it has modest goals. If you look at this, this is a very small instrument. It has a 7-centimeter aperture with a 20-centimeter focal length. So it's basically just a normal camera. So each camera is equipped with a 2K by 2K CCD with 15 micron pixels, and each camera reaches a modest limiting magnitude of 14 when it comes to detecting stars. The field of view is 100 square degrees, and this can all be reached in an exposure of 2 minutes. So it's very wide. So to date, ASUS has cataloged of order 10 million or 20 million stars, and about 50,000 variable stars, and of those 50,000 variable stars, 10,000 of them are eclipsing binaries. So the thing works. Okay, so how could we use ASUS to detect GRB on-axis afterglows? So this is the idea. To increase the number of ASUS-like instruments by a factor of 10 or so, so that we can monitor the entire night sky and hunt for on-axis afterglows. So it's really monitoring the entire night sky quickly. So it works out that if you have 30 or 40 of these ASUS-type instruments, which is an upgrade of a factor of 8, then within and for 1 minute exposures, which you can get, you know, with better CCDs, this will allow ASUS to scan the entire night sky every 15 minutes or 10 to the 3 seconds down to a limiting magnitude of 15. So the strategy, and it's not clear, I think we can actually go deeper than this, but we're still working on what it actually means to get a detection. So detecting a star, for example, is different than detecting a GRB afterglow, right? So the strategy is, in a nutshell, is to go wide so that you get the whole sky, quick so you get the on-axis early time behavior, in this case of order 10 to the 3 seconds, and shallow, 15th magnitude. And look for on-axis orphan afterglows rather than just normal off-axis orphan afterglows, so we can detect potentially GRB central engine behavior in the absence of gamma rays. So what are the advantages of going quick, wide, and shallow? Well, first, ASUS already exists, it works, and it's more or less been tested and proven. Next, the redundancy, I think, is a very important point. If one of the instruments break, then if you have 30 or 40 instruments, then your capability only goes down by 1%. If you're trying to scan the sky with one enormous telescope, if the thing breaks, if the graduate student spills a cup of coffee on it or whatever, then you have to stop the whole thing. Flexibility. If you don't like what your results are in the first month or year or so, then you can easily change your strategy by, for example, changing what your focal lengths of your instruments are and your integration times. Maybe most importantly, it's pretty cheap. Per camera, you can probably get them for $30,000 a piece, maybe a little bit more. And so in all, this is about a $1 million enterprise. And so, and also, if you multiply ASUS by 10 and you don't find too many afterglows, then maybe $1 million is not such a bad thing to spend if all you want to do is get variable stars. And of course, the possibility, as Pavan referred to yesterday, of detecting relativistic outflows or GRB central engine behavior or phenomena similar to GRB central engine behavior in the absence of gamma ray emission. Or in other words, one could term them as white bursts. And so with that, I'll just quickly conclude. So the early time on axis, the flux goes down like 1 over T behavior, is kind of ideal suited for optical surveys that go quick, shallow, and wide. ASUS instruments produce the virtue of being cheap and flexible. If one breaks, the project still goes on with only a few percent loss to its capability. And maybe most importantly, that this quick, wide, and shallow strategy potentially allows people or one to detect GRB central engine activity in the absence of gamma ray bursts. So with that, I'll conclude.
Very short talk for us.
If I understand right, are you basically hoping to, after the fact, look at the data and say, oh yeah, we had this great light curve? Or are you trying to be able to put out
Triggers.
Last image, we found this thing and
put it up. Basically, what will probably end up happening is you get two data points, and that will serve as a trigger.
So I wonder about infrastructure then. Sort of 30K per instrument is not how much it costs also to install and to maintain.
Software.
Are you planning on putting these at sites that are already well developed that can handle a data stream, like what you're thinking about?
I think you're right. I mean, we haven't thought at all about the software or any of that, but in comparison to the large-scale surveys, like, for example, the gigapixel surveys like LSST, I think it's going to be much more manageable in comparison.
Okay. I'm worried about it for you.
Could you tell the results about the non-GRB? I mean, this ASS has been operational now for several years, or at least one. What are the interesting or not so interesting transients and eclipsing objects that you found?
I think it's probably a matter of taste, but in my opinion, the most interesting thing they found is 10,000 eclipsing binaries, which multiplies the total number known by a factor of 5 or more.
Has there been an effort to classify them or to choose the most interesting of the lot?
Well, Pachinski has some classification method. He's written a paper on it recently, of dividing them into three types, into contact, close, or detached, and semi-detached. And I guess that's about all he's done with them.
What's the longest period in there?
1 point something there. Yeah.
What one want to go shallow, but not too shallow, because this one over here did not go all the way. Very small, and there are 50 magnitudes is marginal.
Yeah.
You have a significant fraction of GRBs which never hit 50 magnitudes.
Right.
So.
Right. Okay. So from your talk yesterday, you know, I haven't had time to work up the numbers, but let's just say from your talk yesterday, at around the jet break time, you know, what's the spread in magnitudes around the jet break time? Okay, so scale that, so 10 to the 3 seconds is 10 to the minus 2 days. So scale that up, and then you get 14th to 18th magnitude, right? So if you can get to 16th magnitude, then you make it a significant number, fraction of the population. And so basically, if you look at one of these instruments, in a 1 minute exposure, you get a signal to noise in the V band of order 10. So, which is, in order to scan this guy every 10 to the 3 seconds, is what your exposure time is going to have to be for 30 or 40 instruments. So, maybe that's not what you want to get a star or a variable star, but that might be all you need to get a GRB afterglow.
You can also check, you can also look at the measurement for body telescopes and switch, which actually give you the measurement of significant pattern of the GRB in recent years.
Right.
This time then you will know.
Yeah, I'm a little bit concerned about the detection. We did it in one image, but it's fading very fast. Mm-hmm. You only have it in one image, how do you claim?
He did in two. Right. Like, kind of mathematically speaking, a Fourier transform of 1 point is not, it doesn't make sense, right? You need two points.
How do your photometric error scale at the bright end for ASS? Do you get expected for the noise?
You mean the delta V, for example?
Yeah, what
it's
is that?
Like a tenth of the magnitude.
How much?
A tenth.
Ten.
Or maybe 2 times, but of that order.
No, that's better than that.
It's probably when you're already digging into photonoids, but at the bright end, typically these white field systems, they do about 1.5%.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was wondering if they can monitor large Magellanic cloud and small Magellanic clouds in order to get, I think, the best estimates of normal rates in these two galaxies. I mean, this is a very straight and cheap product of your project.
Galaxy, Nova, 15 planets. And
so, can you observe, can you monitor these two galaxies for this open eyes of the outcome of your project for the GFP search?
Well, so what would it compromise?
So what fraction
of the side of the LMC sub 10, right? What fraction of the side of the LMC sub 10?
600 square degrees.
So 600 square degrees. So this is 30,000 square degrees, right? So probably not.
Do you have any confusion?
That's going to be a problem. Crowding and things like that. That's going to be a problem.
Yeah, I'd like to come back and maybe Brent didn't walk in. His question is: sure, you need to point to say something has gone up. But these are big fat pixels in the sky, right?
Yeah, what like you are tracking the pixel.
Okay, I mean, and these images would be quick, so there could be just some satellite glimpse. So, I mean, will you have like a parallax illuminator sort of a scheme, or is it just going to be one, and then some master database you consult that picture against?
I think
cosmic rays? Oh, cosmic rays, I mean.
Well, you need two events, right? So.
What do you mean two events?
So you have to, so you're scanning, so each camera scanning is some patch of the sky, right?
It's
moving. It has 1 minute exposure, then it goes, 1 minute exposure, then it goes, 1 minute exposure. So it's looking right here, the thing goes off, it sees it, it goes back, and then it has to come back. And if it's gone down a little bit by what you would expect, then you call that a trigger, right? So I think that's the idea.
I mean, but I'm sure the Los Alamos guys have a lot of experience, but won't there be false triggers which are simply not anything cosmic at all, not M dwarf layers, not GRBs, not some eclipsing thing?
It's local things.
And how do you eliminate these? I mean, there must be a lot of this sort of pixel resolution. Or am I wrong?
Well, if you pair study, you need two epochs, but pair at each epoch in order to help. You have to detect it in both of the pair, and then detect again in both of the pair if you're going to believe it's a transit.
And how much, do you have any false alarms, even with that strategy?
There have been things we have to check against, asteroids, there have been flare stars, and so on.
Yeah. But, search it up space and you'll find,
It's a lot of crap on the image that is obvious. You look at it and you see, oh, that's a bit of dust on the chip.
But on these pixel scales, it's going to be a lot harder.
Yes.
QR seconds per pixel cosmic ray, which is like a star.
Yes, but this is when another advantage of a distributed aperture approach comes in, because at the cost of 50% of your server area, you can co-point half of the instruments and have a twofold coincidence right there.
Good.
Is it in your thinking to do different colors as well?
Yeah, well, there's V and I.
Actually, that's a good point. You probably want to avoid the bluer colors for the simple reason most of the dwarf flares are very strongly blue. And you also reduce your immunity to lunar cycle with a somewhat redder sky. You want to think related to that.
No more questions? Thanks. Moving to another survey,